In the light of truth, in the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share. I have a special introduction to make today. I know many of you are here for this reason, but I would like to introduce our special guest speaker preacher this morning. Reverend Michael Dowd is here with his wife, Connie Barlow, and that's not her, that's Allison. Sorry. Reverend Michael Dowd and his wife are the only traveling evangelists that we have in the UUA. They sold their home and have lived out of their van for the past several years. It's a nice van. It's in our parking lot. You'll see it. It's not, I always think of, and I live in a van by the river. You'll see the van. It's large, and it has a picture of a Darwin fish and a Christian fish kissing on the side of it. They've been traveling around the country for 5 or 6 years now, speaking at more than 250 UU churches on this subject about which both of them are passionate, combining honest science with honest religion, something that we talk about a lot here. Today's sermon title comes from his new book of the same name, Thank God for Evolution. And again, you'll see the fish motif on the front with a fossil of a fish. This book has been endorsed by 5 Nobel laureates and over 120 other scientists. We are honored and delighted to welcome Reverend Dowd to our pulpit this morning, and also want you to know that he'll be doing public program here tonight at 7 o'clock, to which you will want to invite friends. And he also has a table here to the left of the sanctuary where you can see books and CDs and DVDs, and he can let you know about that. So please welcome Reverend Dowd. Thank you.
Whatever your name for ultimate reality is, I invite you, I invite us to open our hearts to receive, to be a receptive mode, so that we might receive inspiration, we might receive guidance, we might receive comfort. No matter where you've come from, no matter what your week has been like, no matter what disappointments there may have been, what challenges or difficulties you may have had to deal with, or what joys or celebrations there may have been, I invite you to be here now in this place, present to this time and this energy, so that we might all leave this place and truly be ministers. That is, may we be a blessing, and may we be filled and inspired to do that here today, now. I invite you to close your eyes or have them open, but to attend to your breathing. Just notice the rise and the fall of your chest and the feeling of the air going in and out of your nostrils or your mouth. I know I sometimes find it helpful to say to myself, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. And then just simply in on the in-breath and out on the out-breath. And as you notice your breath, I invite you to also be present to the feeling of your body resting comfortably, your hands and legs, the feeling of your weight upon the chair. As you continue to notice your breathing, notice also the feeling of your body. When we quiet our minds by simply noticing our breath, by noticing what we can sense with our senses,
We come into the present moment. We come here and experience the grace of this moment right now, right here with each other. And with each breath, we literally breathe in atoms that were created in stars. We breathe in atoms that were cycling around this room that have been exhaled by others. We literally interexist with each other by simply breathing in the same room. And as we breathe, we recognize that we have this moment because we are part of a larger body, the body of life. If it weren't for the food that you've eaten, the water and other liquids that we've drunk, and the breathing that goes on every minute, we couldn't exist. So whatever your name for ultimate reality is, I invite you to be in receptive mode, and I'm going to be silent, and just hear what that reality is speaking to your heart. I invite you to particularly pay attention to the middle of your chest, the region of your heart, and see what wisdom, what guidance, what counsel, what anything is spoken to that place in your heart in this place of silence. And then when you're ready, I invite you to open your eyes and well, I was going to say good morning, but I see it's afternoon, so good afternoon. This is only the second time I've ever been to Austin, and actually this area of Texas is pretty new to me, and I find it just particularly gorgeous, both the climate and the terrain. Connie and I, for the last 5.5 years, actually it'll be 6 years in April, have lived entirely traveling North America. We don't have a home. We don't even have a storage bin. You know, we've got a few boxes of memorabilia farmed out with family. But basically, what we do is we live out of the generosity of people who open up their homes to us. And we teach and preach a sacred, meaningful, inspiring, hopefully, way of thinking about the entire history of the universe. That is, we take the 14 billion year epic of evolution that, you know, 96-98% of the scientists of the world would agree with. We don't focus on where there's legitimate disagreement in terms of some of the details of the evolutionary story. Some of that stuff's really cool. But what we focus on is where there's broad agreement. That is this 14 billion year trajectory. And when I use the word evolution, that's really what I'm meaning. It's the history of cosmos, earth, life, and humanity as one sacred story, one meaningful story. We believe that that story is already in the process of transforming the religious traditions and helping us cooperate across ethnic and religious differences in service of a healthy world. In fact, the reason that Connie and I have lived on the road for 5.5 years and why we anticipate probably living on the road the rest of our lives is because we are committed to the vision of what our mentors, among others, Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, call the great work. I mean, you could say every age has its great work to do. It's kind of a collective calling of that time and place. Our way of describing the great work of our time is the work of ensuring a just, healthy, beautiful, and sustainably life-giving future for humanity and as many other species as possible. I mean, if we don't do that work in the next 100 years or so, there won't be any work to be done. So that, we think, is the great work of our time. But how do each one of us find and fulfill our own unique role in this great work of ensuring a thriving future for as many species as possible? How do we do so from a place of hope and possibility rather than fear and overwhelm? I mean, I'm going to assume that most of you here, whether you're Unitarian or whether you're a visitor, whether you have no connection to this particular tradition or not, I'm going to assume that most of you really have a desire to see peace and justice and sustainability, ecological sustainability, happen in our world. However, most of us are bombarded with bad news. I mean, because that's what's considered newsworthy. So we're not exposed to some of the long-term evolutionary trends nor short-term historic trends that can wake us up fired up and excited to co-create a healthy world together. What I'd like to share with you are several of the things that many people have an awakening or an aha around this. And then, again, I'll be touching on things this morning. This evening from 7 to 9, I'll be going into a lot more depth on virtually everything I talk about this morning. First of all, though, I need to give you a little more background, because you can probably tell from my style already, I used to be an anti-evolutionary fundamentalist. I actively opposed people who taught evolution. In fact, I had a small stack of tracts, and I would argue with anybody who thought the world was more than 6,000 years old. And now I travel all over North America with my atheist wife popularizing a sacred way of thinking about evolution. So however you understand ultimate reality, clearly there's a sense of humor here. In fact, driving through this part of the world, you know, the South, Texas, Alabama, Georgia, we get some interesting looks, occasionally some interesting gestures. We pulled into Lawrence, Kansas, and this biology professor looks at the side of the van and he goes, "Oh, great, you just piss everybody off." Sometimes seems that way. Connie and I believe that evolution will usher religion into its greatness in the 21st century. That no religion could possibly come into its glory. No religion could emerge into its full potential until deep time was understood. Why? Because all religions came into being when people thought the world was flat, stationary, and we were at the center of the universe. Shintoism, Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, all these great faiths came into being when people thought the world was flat and that everything revolved around us. In fact, people didn't believe the sun and the stars revolved around us. They thought they knew it. It was like, go out and look. Duh. Yeah. Certainly how it looks, right? And yet today we have such an amazing understanding of the nature of the universe that the ancients couldn't have possibly had. In fact, have you ever seen nesting dolls, like Russian nesting dolls, like dolls within dolls within dolls, right? A fundamental truth that we now understand about the nature of reality that there's just no disagreement about. Connie and I do programs in every kind of religious and non-religious setting imaginable. We do lots of Unitarian Universalist churches. The UUs are the low-hanging fruit when it comes to evolution. It's really easy to, you know, go into a UU church and speak about evolution. But we've also done programs I've done many programs in Christian churches, Roman Catholic, Protestant. I was with 125 evangelical ministers a couple months ago down in the Bahamas, which is not a bad place to be with anybody, but it was great. But I've done programs at Buddhist meditation centers, Quaker meeting houses, Mennonite churches, and nobody debates with this nested nature of reality. The nested nature of what I call divine creativity. Subatomic particles, like nesting dolls. Subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within planets, within galaxies, within, you know, all the way up and all the way down. Every level can create. Every level expresses what I call divine creativity. And when I say divine, what I'm meaning is the power to bring something new into existence that never existed before. I mean, that's a classic attribute of the divine, right? The creator. That force, that reality that created everything. What we now know, and I say know rather than believe, is that divine creativity didn't merely exist at the beginning of time and make everything the way a potter makes a pot or a carpenter makes a table. Divine creativity exists throughout the entire universe in a nested sense. And we are part of the process. We are the universe, after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution, now becoming conscious of itself. Human beings are literally nature uncovering its own nature. We're the universe becoming aware of itself. Literally. The universe has gone from simple atoms to more complex atoms, to molecules, to more complex molecules, to creatures, to more complex creatures, to societies and more complex societies. And it's one unfolding process that we emerge out of. We emerge out of this process. And remember the nesting dolls? We're a subset of the whole. We can't get outside the whole to understand it or to examine it. So the nature of the whole, the nature of ultimate reality, will always be beyond anything we can know, think, or imagine. And yet it's also expressed or revealed through us. And God, or the goddess, or Allah, or Wankantankan, or Great Spirit, or any other divine name, is a proper name, a sacred name, for that ultimate reality that includes all of the realities, yet transcends all of the realities. In other words, the only reality that's not a subset of some larger, more comprehensive creativity or more comprehensive reality. Now, you don't have to use divine names to describe the nature of ultimate reality, but clearly it would be legitimate to do so, and it's traditionally been done. But as a subset of the whole, trying to understand the whole, how would we talk about it? As human language evolves in different parts of the world, we would have reflected on different plants, different animals, different terrain, and different climate, right? I mean, those of us living in a harsh desert climate are living in a very different world than those of us living in a lush tropical climate. In fact, we don't even know about each other's world. And so the plants and the animals and the terrain and the climate are going to be different. And the words that we create, because words come out of our experience, right? So the words that we would create would reflect our experience and the stringing together of words into stories that explained where did we come from, why are things like they are, where is everything going, and why we're special as a people. And all cultures have these. There's not a single culture anywhere in the world that doesn't have a cosmology or a creation story. These stories are going to be different, necessarily. I mean, if we over here had never experienced sheep, the Lamb of God wouldn't be a part of our tradition. If we over here had never experienced the political reality of a king, the kingdom of God would be a totally foreign concept. You know, we'd tell stories of lotus blossoms or whatever was a part of our experience. So all religions make sense given the different bioregions and cultures in which they emerge. Now, this doesn't mean they all make sense if you interpret their core doctrines literalistically. But if you interpret their core understandings, their core doctrines in a cosmological way, that is saying something true about the reality and our relationship to it, it becomes easy to understand religious differences. This is not difficult. And so we can and because we're a subset of the whole, there's not going to be one right way to talk about the nature of ultimate reality. So what this means, among other things, is we can stop fighting and killing each other over our respective metaphors and analogies for ultimate reality or for the whole, which I realize is news maybe to many of you, but it's not news to some of your neighbors. This is where this evolution theology perspective, which is a radical difference, it's a radical third way from the intelligent design creationist type folks, and those two are not the same. Young earth creationism, that is people who believe that the world is 6,000 years old, and intelligent design people, most of whom are old earth creationists, that is they think the universe is billions of years old. But you've got these folks, and then you've got your new atheists, your Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett. And right now, at least in terms of the media, many people think those are the two games in town. Well, this evolution theology is as grounded in science as these folks. In fact, Richard Dawkins allowed me to reprint a letter that he wrote to his 10-year-old daughter as an appendix in my book. Now, my publisher said, you'll never get Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, and one of the most well-known atheists on the planet. My publisher said, you'll never get Richard to let you reprint a letter of his in your book called Thank God for Evolution. Within 24 hours of sending him the email, he said, sure, go ahead. Because he and my wife have known each other for a number of years. In fact, he said, go, I wish you and Connie the best. Now, he said, Michael, don't expect me to blurb your book, however. Not going to do that. That's fine. But this evolution theology is as inspiring and religiously nourishing and satisfying in a deep emotional, moral way as what these folks are trying to do. Yet it's grounded in empirical science. Not only does it give us a multiplicity of ways of talking about ultimate reality, but as I said, it gives us a more intimate relationship. We are the universe becoming aware of itself. We are nature uncovering its own nature. Literally. A human being looking through a telescope is the universe, looking at itself and just gawking, like, wow. A biology student looking through a microscope is the planet Earth learning with awareness, with consciousness, how it's functioned unconsciously and instinctually for billions of years. Brian Swim is a physicist friend of ours. He's got these great quotes. He says, 4 billion years ago, the Earth was molten rock, and now it sings opera. Earth was once molten rock, now it sings opera, right? And nobody put anything here. When the Bible, like Genesis 2:7, speaks of God forming us from the dust of the ground and breathing into us the breath of life, that's a true story. It's a traditionally sacred way, a mythic way of describing the fact that we grow out of the dynamics of the planet itself, and it's a divine creative reality of the whole, in this case personified as God, that makes that possible. I mean, how could Moses have said it any other way, assuming he wrote that? Here's another quote from Brian. Again, Brian Swim is a physicist. He's a cosmologist. He likes to sum up things kind of in cute ways that help people like, whoa, get it? He tries to take the entire 14-billion-year epic of evolution, sum it up in two sentences. A little audacious, but I think you'll like it. He says, you take a great cloud of hydrogen gas, and you just leave it alone. And it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings. Folks, that's not considered a belief. That's considered factual knowledge. 98% of the scientists of the world would agree with what I just said. See, there's a difference between belief and knowledge. And I believe that in my lifetime, I'm only 14 billion and 49 years old, right? I believe that in my lifetime, the majority of the world's religious believers will become religious knowers. And in that process, they will not just tolerate an evolutionary ecological worldview, they will wholeheartedly embrace it. Why? Because their own core insights, their own core doctrines or truths will be seen in a larger, more meaningful, more this world realistic way than ever before. Again, I'll share a whole lot more on this evening. But this sense that we are nature becoming aware of itself, as this understanding is integrated into Christianity, into Buddhism, into Islam, into all the different faith traditions, we will see the potential these traditions unlock in an unbelievable way. And I think that's going to happen in the next 50 years. And what this does, among other things, is it gives us back the kinds of awarenesses, for example, that the native peoples, the tribal peoples, indigenous peoples have had. For example, Black Elk, the great Native American elder, who was also a Christian, he said, the first piece and the most important is that which comes within the souls of men and women when they realize their relationship, their oneness with the universe and all its powers. So here we see an indigenous insight that is validated and furthered in our understanding because of science. And when I say science, let me share what I'm meaning when I say the word science. What I'm meaning is public revelation. See, there's a distinction between private revelation and public revelation. Private revelation is an insight that comes through the psyche of one individual who then has to communicate that insight to others, and others may or may not believe. You know, Moses goes to the top of the mountain. God reveals something, or something happens, he tells other people about it. Or the Apostle Paul is on the road to Damascus, blinding flash of light, revelation, he tells other people about it. Or an insight comes to you, and you tell somebody about it. Private revelation, by its very nature, produces religious believers or unbelievers. Because if I have an insight and tell you about it, you may or may not believe me. Public revelation is what's being revealed about the nature of reality. What's so? What's divinely true? Like what's fundamentally the case that's coming not merely through the psyche of one individual, although sometimes it's introduced that way. You know, Einstein has a vision of riding a beam of light and he publishes a paper and the whole scientific community then goes to work trying to disprove it. The scientific method, the skeptical scientific method is all about trying to discern, is this true or not? It's a process of collective intelligence. Our species is becoming more collectively intelligent because of the scientific method, because of this understanding, which results in what I call public revelation. That is, it's revealing what's so publicly, collectively. And private revelation is not nearly as widely useful in most cases as public revelation. And when you get that God cannot possibly be less than a sacred name for ultimate reality, right? Again, you don't have to use God language, but it would be legitimate to do so. When you realize that, you realize that facts are God's native tongue. In other words, where we go to first and foremost for what God, what ultimate reality is revealing, aren't texts written 2,000-3,000 years ago, as inspiring from as they are for many people, but where we go to first and foremost is what God, ultimate reality, is revealing through the entire range of sciences today. I mean, who of us would let a first century dentist fill our children's teeth? Yet so many of us, or at least so many of our neighbors, let first century theologians fill our children's minds every day. It's because we haven't had these distinctions. I'm not making conservatives wrong. Please don't hear me on this. I'm just saying that we haven't had these distinctions between private and public revelation. We haven't had the distinction as facts as God's native tongue. We haven't had a way of understanding evolution that even conservative religious believers can feel in their guts is holy or sacred or God-glorifying, to use that kind of religious language. The last thing I want to share this morning is that in our differences, I mean, one of the things I love about being in Unitarian Universal circles is that where else can you go? Like, really, where else in this culture can you go that in one church, one association, you've got strong atheists, humanists, religious naturalists, you've got all of us recovering Baptists, recovering Catholics, recovering Presbyterians, all the things we're recovering from. You've got some of us that aren't in recovery at all. We just also happen to be UUs. You've got nondescript spiritual seekers that want to have their kids to have a liberal education, you know. And then you've got, you know, pagans and Jews and Buddhists, like, in one church. And some of us love God language and some of us barf at God language. Some of us love ritual and some of us hate ritual. We're all over the map on all kinds of things. But the amazing thing is that in our differences, we can stand shoulder to shoulder and co-create a just, healthy, and thriving future for humanity and as many other species as possible. And there's an exercise that I'm going to offer in a way that will help you find and fulfill your own role in this process, which is an exercise to take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, so you get two columns. On the left-hand side, list all of the activities, the projects, the things that you love to do that light you up, that give you joy, that give you a sense of energy and fulfillment and happiness. You know, things that you're good at, things other people tell you that you're good at, etc. List it all. And it doesn't have to be practical. Maybe it's stuff you haven't done since you were a teenager. You've never done it, but the thought of doing it in your lifetime gives you a little juice, gives you a little charge. You list it. The top of that list, you put my great joy. Then on the right-hand side, list all the things that you're aware of in your community or in the world where you feel the world's needs. Like, not just where you intellectually know about what's needed, but where does it hit you? Where do you feel it? Where do you feel frustrated or depressed or angry? And especially, where do you feel compassion? Where does your heart just break over something that's happening in your community or in the world? And you list all that. At the top of that list, you put the world's great needs as I feel them. So you get two lists, your great joy and the world's great needs. Then just pay attention to this part of your body. You don't have to call it prayer or meditation if you don't want to. Just pay attention to your heart and ask guidance from right here to see potential intersections on your list. What you're basically trying to do is play mix and match. Where are the intersections between what lights you up, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, and what the world's needs are or your community's needs as you feel them? And those places of intersection where your great joy and the world's great needs intersect, that's your calling. It's your mission. It's your vocation. It's where you can be the growing edge of what God or the goddess or the universe or revolution or whatever you want to call this sacred creative process is up to. And whether you can make money at it or not is irrelevant. If you take one step a month in the direction of where your joy and the world's needs intersect, it will nourish you at the depths of your being. And if you do this exercise with someone who knows you, they're going to help you see intersections on your list that you'll completely miss. And you'll help them see intersections on their list that they'll miss. I've had 7-year-olds and I've had 91-year-olds that have given me feedback that they've done this exercise. Many people find it life-changing. Almost everybody finds it helpful. Last thing I want to say is that what I'll be sharing tonight will be going into everything I've just shared in much greater depth, but I'll also be sharing a whole piece on where I think is the salvation of the liberal churches. One of the reasons why I think young people are not exactly flocking to our churches is that we don't address the human condition in any deeply science-based and religiously inspiring way. And there's a whole realm of called evolutionary brain science and evolutionary psychology that helps us come to an understanding of ourselves. Why are we the way that we are? Why do we struggle with the things that we struggle with? Why are we tempted by the things that we are tempted by? Why do we fall to the things that we fall to? Is it merely because our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother ate an apple? Or is it because our instincts evolved in a world that we no longer live in? For example, for 99% of human history, it was not easy to find sugars, salts, and fats. So having a craving for sugar, salts, and fats allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. Yet today, it's very easy to find foods that have sugar, salts, and fats, yet we still have these cravings. It's part of our unchosen nature. It's our inherited proclivities. It's what Christians are pointing to using mythic night language, and I'll talk about day and night language tonight, but using traditional religious language, what they're trying to point to, an intuition, when they talk about original sin or the fall, but we now have a science way of understanding that gives us not only a deeper understanding of our nature, like why we are the way that we are, but also gives us the understanding and tools for how we can stay in integrity and thrive and our relationships thrive. Did you know that there's a scientifically proven correlation between the amount of testosterone in a human organism and how much that organism tends to take risks and think about sex? There's a woman, a friend of mine in California. She was on a hormonal therapy, right? She had to wear testosterone patches. She said, "I can't stop thinking about sex. Is this what guys have to deal with?" The answer is yes! But it's not just guys, right? I mean, women can have larger levels of testosterone. In fact, my daughter is life's ever-present reminder to me that there's a wisdom larger than my ego at work, because I was a peace activist for much of my adult life. My oldest daughter is not only a sergeant in the Marine Corps, she's one of the first women in U.S. history to be on the all-Marine wrestling team. My baby girl wrestles for the Marine Corps, and she kicks butt. But here's the interesting thing, and I'll conclude on this note. Men and women can have a certain base level of testosterone, but if they then get voted into office, and it doesn't have to be a big political office, it could be your school board, right? Or if you get promoted at work, or if you become ordained, or if you become a therapist, or in any way a rise in status, your testosterone levels will not only rise, but sometimes they'll shoot through the roof. And this is true of all primates, including humans. Now, if you're caught unprepared for this, okay? So let's say you got a great relationship with your spouse, no problem. Okay, and we're talking men and women here, okay? Things are going great, your partner, your spouse, no problem, no temptation. And then you get promoted at work. And all of a sudden, you got sex on the brain, right? Now, if you interpret this as though maybe something's wrong with your relationship to your spouse, or maybe it's God's will that you connect with Sarah Jane over here, or if you interpret it as though it's simply because you're fundamentally evil or flawed, or because Eve and Adam ate an apple, you're not going to know how to stay in impeccable integrity. You're going to lack the understanding and lack the tools to have thriving relationships, and you're going to leave a wake. It's problematic. And so that's why this is not an excuse. This perspective is profoundly freeing, and it deepens our understanding of ancient religious understandings like the fall or original sin. It realizes, that is, it makes real what we thought were supernatural or otherworldly religious ideals. It realizes them. So again, I'll share a lot more about that this evening. If you know that you can't come tonight, you already got a commitment or whatever, what I recommend are DVDs. Each of these is 4 hours of our best programs. And so, we give you the rights to make copies. So if you have a color printer, you can print off the covers. You can make copies, as many as you want, for other people very inexpensively. And then, of course, my book has got everything that I'll be talking about tonight and today. And if you cannot afford the book, it's $25. If you can't afford it, the entire book is available for free on my website. If you go to thankgodforevolution.com, a PDF of the entire book is available. You can download the whole thing for free. We just want to get the word out. I'd like to conclude with a quote from Brian Swim. I've quoted him a couple times already. And this will give you a sense of why Connie and I live on the road and why we'll probably live on the road the rest of our lives. And it goes like this. I am convinced that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement, the scientific enterprise's central gift to humanity. Let me say that again. He says, I am convinced that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement, the scientific enterprise's central gift to humanity. For the first time in human history, we finally have a creation story that's not tied to one cultural tradition, nor to a political ideology, but instead gathers every human group into its meanings. We are in the midst of a revelatory experience of the universe that must be compared in its magnitude with those of the great religious revelations. And we need only wander about telling this great story to ignite a transformation of humanity. Connie and I have taken that last sentence very literally. Thank you.